If I look like Frankenstein, it's because I hurt my back about a month ago. So when I take this off and you see the brace, don't be shocked. Every time I come to St. Louis, I like to read what I'm working on. I like to read what I'm working on, and so I'm going to read tonight parts of this memoir that I'm working on, and then I'll read some poems. But I've got about 400 pages into this memoir, and it's about my father and myself and my son, whose name is Quincy. Actually, it's a kind of meditation on men and fathers and friends and males. And so this is I'm going to read the section that is part of the second chapter. But before that, I'm going to read this poem for my father, because this is my father's, every time he died in 1993, and I said I would read this poem every time I read. Shut up, God damn it. Poem for my father, for Quincy T. Troop Sr., or as he used to say, Troupe. Father, it was an honor to be there in the dugout with you. The glory of great black men swinging their lives as bats at tiny white balls burning in at unbelievable speeds, riding up and in and out. A curve breaking down wicket like a ball falling off a high table, moving away, snaking down, screwing its stitch magic into chitling circuit air, its comma seam spinning toward breakdown, dipping. Like a hipster, bebopping, a knee-deep stride in the Charlie Parker 40s, wrist curling like a swan's neck behind a slick black back, cupping an invisible ball of dreams. And you there, father, regal as an African, a boa man, a boa man, a boa man. Sculpted out of wood from a sacred tree of no name, no place origin. Thick branches branching down into Cherokee and someplace else lost way back in Africa. The sap running dry, crossing from North Carolina into Georgia, inside Grandmother Mary's womb, who was your mother and had you there in the violence of that red soil. Ink blotter news gone now into blood and bone graves of American blues, sponging, rococo, truth long gone as dinosaurs, the Agent Orange landscape of former names, absent of African polysyllables, dry husk consonants there now in their place, names, flat as polluted rivers. And that guitar string smile, that guitar, 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 guitar string smile, always snaking across some virulent American redneck space, scorching like atomic heat, mushrooming over Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the fever blistered shadows of it all, inked as body etchings into sizzle concrete. But you there, father, yes, through it all, a yard bird solo, ripping on bat and ball glory, breaking down all fabricated myths of white major league legends, of who was better than who, beating them at their own crap game, crap game, crap game, beating them at their own crap game with killer bats. As Bud Powell swung his silence into beauty of a Josh Gibson home run, skittering across piano keys of bleachers, shattering all manufactured legends up there in lights, struck out white knights on the risky, slippery edge of amazement. Oh. The miraculous truth slipping through, steep and disguised in the blues, confluencing, confluencing like the point at the cross when a fastball hides up, up in a shimmying slide, a curve, breaking down and away, breaking down, down, down and away, breaking down, down, down and away, in a wicked slide grid, curved and posed, curved and broke down, like the back of an ass-scratching Uncle Tom, who like old Satchel Paige
stage, delivering his famed hesitation pitch before coming back with a hard half-fast one, rising. You're sometimes slicker, slipping and sliding, slipping and sliding, slipping and sliding, and quicker than a professional hitman. The deadliness of it all. The sudden strike, like that of the Brown Bomber's short crossing right, or the hook of Sugar Ray Robinson's lightning cobra bite. And you there, Father, yes, through it all, catching rhythms of China Pozo balls, drumming like Cuban conga beats into your catcher's mitt, hard and fast, hard and fast, hard and fast, hard and fast, as Cool Papa Bell jumping in the bed before the lights went out of the old Negro Baseball League. A promise you were, Father, yes. A harbinger of shockwaves. Shockwaves, shockwaves, shock, 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 shock. Shockwaves, shockwaves. Soon come. Soon come. Now I'm going to read this prose, because every time I come to St. Louis, I like to try out my new shit. And, you know, I haven't read this before, so if it's got some kinks in it, I'll know it, and I'll go back and I'll work on it. And so this is about 400 pages long now, and this is the first time it's been read in public. So don't boo too loud. So this is the second chapter, and this is, I should set this up. I'm trying to talk about my father and my mother's in it, and my mother's right there. And on this particular day, I'm trying to deal with him because he just come back from... Yes, yes, yes. She likes the attention. I didn't say she didn't. I didn't say she didn't. I love my mama. Anyway, my father's just come back from Mexico and in this scene, so I don't want to set it up. And I'm going to set it up a little bit, and then I'm going to read it. My father, in my mind, had all the traits most heroes and stars have who never get past their own fame and legend. In his private mind, he could do no wrong. Was never an asshole because he never saw any contradictions in his life. After all, he was a king in his own mind, even though he didn't ever admit this in public. And as royalty, he felt himself deserving of any and all things he thought he should have. But in his public view of himself, my father thought of himself as a humble man. One without vanity, unselfish, a person who shared with others, was generous, a person filled with humility and kindness. What's that? Shit. In reality, thank you so much. I thought there was a wind coming in here, goddammit. You know, I thought that was the 1927 tornado. In reality, my father could be a kind man if you caught him right, could be generous if you caught him in the right mood. But he was always selfish, self-centered, vain, and never, ever humble, even though he acted as though he was, which is sometimes a trait of the prodigiously talented, as my father was when it came to athletics. He was, by many accounts, one of the greatest all-around athletes Missouri ever produced. It's almost as if many of those who are prodigiously talented feel they have to act humble in public, especially many gifted athletes, in front of their adoring public, we simple mortal beings, who have nowhere near this kind of talent. So many, not all, try to act humble in front of their fawning fans, put on their public faces of humility, so that we mere mortals won't get too jealous
because of their blessedness. My father was blessed and was good at acting out all shucks. I'm only a baseball player in front of his legion of adoring fans. When I was growing up, my father was not only a hero for me and my brother, but he was also a hero for the rest of our community. I remember everyone loving him to death, and why not? He was tall, 6'3", strong, handsome, and very clean. But humble he wasn't. He was used to having his own way in just about everything. I remember one incident that occurred when my father returned from a baseball trip to either Mexico or Puerto Rico that opened my eyes to just how much he was used to having his way. I was about 10 or 11 years old at the time. My mother and father had broken up, and we had moved because my mother had less money. Because, as I later learned, he wasn't always forthcoming with child support money for our care. We had moved from Easton to Delmore and Leonard Streets, an area of St. Louis that was further downtown and cheaper and rougher than where we previously lived. Across the street from where we lived, up over Joe's Supermarket, was a wall of three-story dull gray row houses, replaced now by squat little project houses that was full of angry black people, many of whom always seemed to be fighting over one thing or another. Most of them were hardworking, God-fearing Christian people who never made much money, which was the big source of much of their anger. But they were proud, good people, most of them who would give you the shirt off their backs if they liked you. But there were others amongst them who didn't work, were hardcore criminal types who didn't give a goddamn about anyone. That's the way it was in St. Louis. Everybody was thrown up next to each other. These people would just as soon cut or shoot you as look at you. Anger and rage had already consumed them, and they took out their anger on anyone who came within reach, and especially at the little bucket of blood on the corner called Myers Tavern, where black people died with ridiculous ease from street surgeons' knives every Friday or Saturday after a night of drinking. I know, I used to watch them beat, maim, and kill each other from my bedroom window that looked out over the scene. Some were beaten to death. I once saw a man beaten to death with a baseball bat. Some were shot, but most were cut to death, as was the fashion back then during the 50s when I was growing up in St. Louis. Things have changed now. Today, they mostly shoot your ass in St. Louis. But back then, the knife or razor was the weapon of choice. But on this day, when my father returned home and came to visit us, it seemed like all the people who lived in those row houses across the street from us turned out just to get a glimpse of him after he parked his spanking new forest green Chrysler in the middle of Delmore and strode like the clean he knew he was to ring our doorbell. It was in the evening because I remember it being kind of dark outside. The street lights were on, and it was perhaps late summer or early fall. I don't remember which, but only that it was warm. I just happened to be looking out the window, surveying the scene, when my father arrived for his surprise visit. I remember seeing him getting out of his car, and all of a sudden, it just seemed that throngs of people came from out of nowhere, came from out of all those row houses, from out of nowhere. I've only seen this sudden appearance of throngs of people happen only one other time in my life, and that was when this happened to Muhammad Ali in downtown Kinshasa, Zaire, in 1974, just before he won the heavyweight championship back from George Foreman. They rushed up to greet my father, swarming all around him just to shake his hand or either just to stand around and gape at this large, very famous man. I remember feeling as proud as any kid could have possibly have felt at that moment. Bolting from the window, I literally flew out of my room like a bat out of hell, screaming through the house, "Daddy's here!" Those words trailed like a bright banner behind my back as I tore down the narrow, dark stairs, 28 of them to be exact, opened the front door, ran out into the sidewalk and through the stunned crowd to where my father was standing, flashing 32 pearly white teeth. He had crossed the street and the crowd had followed him. I remember screaming, "Daddy, Daddy," as I threw myself up into his arms and hugged him around the neck, openly weeping with joy. I remember the crowd staring at me with a look that seemed like a mixture of amazement, pride, happiness, and envy. especially amongst some of my friends like Billy Speed, the first homosexual that I ever knew. Billy lived across the street from me. Billy seemed a little jealous of me at the time because maybe he didn't have a father. He didn't have a father who was as famous as mine, but maybe I am imagining feeling something now from him in all this distance that wasn't there. Something that has been embellished by the passing of time and the refiguring of my own imagination. And maybe this is what I wanted them to feel, indeed needed them to feel, so that I could perhaps feel apart from them in some way, perhaps better than them or above them. I don't know. I've lost contact with Billy, so I don't know what he was feeling then. But I believe what I felt that day was true. Feel fairly certain that mixture of pride, happiness, and jealousy was what I saw in Billy's eyes. But even if those looks were what I thought I saw, what does it matter now? What matters is that we were good friends then. And what I think I remember of this episode now never came between us back then. And that's all that should matter. The real friendship that we had, that's all that really matters. In any event, I remember my father smiling that slightly crooked smile of his that was so smashing for me. And I guess everybody else too. As I said, he was clean as a broke dick dog, wearing a dark pinstripe suit and a terrifyingly bad gray silk shirt and some out-of-sight kicks that were polished so bright, I could have sworn I saw the reflection of my own face in the mirror surface of the upper front toe. When I ran down to greet my father that evening, I remember my brother, Timmy, being right behind me, jumping up and down for his chance to hop up into my father's arms. He was happy as I was. After Timmy got his hugs, Daddy told us that he had a present for us. And I remember asking him what it was and him just smiling mysteriously and beckoning Timmy and I with his index finger to follow him across the street back to his car. I remember the three of us along with the crowd crossing Delmar, a street that seemed so wide back then and so narrow today, to his car. I remember Daddy smiling that crooked smile of his again. He did this whenever he was happy or about to spring a surprise on you. And some odd, dark thing shaped with flapping ears jumping up and down behind the rolled-up windows of his car. What was it? I remember thinking to myself, my brother just was as curious as I was because he was straining and shading his eyes to try and make out what was in there. So was the crowd. My father opened the door of his car and with a flourish reached in and brought out a young, bouncing, wide-eyed Cocker Spaniel puppy. He was beautiful and eager, and I remember Daddy handing him to me and saying, "Hold him, he's yours. Now you can get rid of Jip, because he ain't nothing but a mongrel. And this Cocker Spaniel is a pedigree with papers and everything. Y'all gonna love him, just wait and see." And then I remember him saying, his smile more ready than usual, "Nothing but the best for my two young men. Nothing but the best." I remember it like it was yesterday. I was shocked and so was Timmy. I remember us not knowing what to say or do. So we just stood there, kind of stood there, looking up at our father, at the crowd of gathered faces, and then down at the beautiful red puppy eagerly licking both our faces, fidgeting, a little nervous. And then it happened. Jip, who was a mongrel dog we had found on the street a couple of years back and whom everyone in our family had grown to love, had bolted through the wide open door and ran out into the street, his wide brown, black and white head surging forward, tongue hanging out, his eyes wide and bright and full of love, and his long ears flapping up and down as he ran like Bobar, the flying pink elephant. Then we saw the car hurtling out of the darkness like a runaway locomotive, its headlights shining brightly as those of a giant, ravenous predator just before they make a kill on some hapless creature. At first, we were surprised and then hopeful that Jip would get out of the way and be spared, but he never really saw the car coming nor heard it, so intent was he to reach us until it was right up on him, and then it was too late. I remember Jip turning his head slightly toward the car just before it hit him. It was almost as if I was watching a slow motion movie. And then I heard the sickening thud of speeding steel meeting flesh, bone and gristle and the terrible surprise howl of Jip's initial pain at the force of the impact, and then the thumpity, thumpity, thump, thump of the car wheels rolling and charging over Jip's body, and then it was over, and the car kept going, hurtling, without even so much as a hint of a pause, into the night. And the only thing I remember of the driver is that he was male and white. There was a moment of stunned surprise as the car sped away, vanishing just as quickly as it had appeared. And then we heard the low, stunned, pitiful moans coming from Jip, who was laying prostrate there in the middle of the street. After we recovered our senses, Timmy and I ran screaming Jip's name up to where he lay, tears running furiously down our young faces as if a dam in both of us had burst wide open. I remember Jip bleeding from his nose, eyes, ears, and mouth. When we reached him, he was only whimpering, his eyes wide open but seemingly going blank as if he couldn't see anybody. We were calling out his name, but he didn't seem to hear us. He just lay there whimpering. I told Timmy to run and tell Mother. Maybe she could do something for him. So he turned and ran, weeping across the street and into the house. It was getting darker. I got down on the ground so I could look closer at Jip. I tried to move him and that got his attention because he howled in pain and actually almost bared his teeth in a snarl. My father told me not to touch him because he might have something broke, some broken bones. I remember thinking that it was me and Timmy's fault for leaving the front door wide open. Then I cried harder. My father patted me on my head and told me not to worry. I looked at my father, and for the first time in his life, he seemed to be looking at Jip with some concern. Something had run up to Jip to sniff at him. It was the young Cocker Spaniel puppy. Jip snarled at him, baring his teeth again. Maybe he was all right, I thought to myself, if he could do that. Quickly, my father picked up the puppy and put him in the car. It was then that I noticed Jip's right leg, how grotesquely twisted and weird it seemed. Blood was running out of a wound to his right shoulder. A bone was sticking out white in the night like a sharp blade. Seeing it terrified me because I had never seen anything like that before. Look, I told my father, pointing at Jip's shoulder. Look at Jip's bone sticking out like that. What's the matter with him? Now my father noticed it too, and said only that it looked bad for Jip. I don't know what I expected from him, but I didn't expect this for an answer. And so I remember looking at him, feeling angry, and feeling something inside of me kind of give way. And I think it was at that moment that I began to transfer the blame for Jip getting hit from Timmy and myself to my father. I don't know why. It wasn't his fault. He didn't run out and leave the front door wide open so Jip could run out. Timmy and I did that. But when you're 10 or 11, you don't think rationally like that. You just assign blame for whatever it is that is paining you and never, ever place blame on yourself at that age, at least not initially. And so it was about then that I knew that I would reject my father's gift of that beautiful Cocker Spaniel. And even if I had known it before but just couldn't admit it to myself, I knew it then. And so I blurted out to my father's suddenly shocked face and to the stunned, saddened faces of the crowd gathered around Jip, I don't want your dog. I don't want him. Take him away. It's your fault and yours that Jip got hit. I don't want him. Now, Junior, you just wait a minute. I remember my father saying, a little concern and anger in his eyes, it's not my fault that your dog got hit. I just came to visit you and brought you a gift, he went on. It's not my fault. Yes, it is, I screamed. Yes, it is. You and your no-good dog. And I don't want him either. And he ain't prettier than Jip, neither. I was screaming at the top of my lungs. The crowd, so joyous a few minutes ago, was totally quiet now, not knowing what to do or say. My father looked stricken. I'll never forget that look on his face. It was a mixture of shock, bafflement, and anger. My father wasn't used to being rejected, and especially by a son who idolized him. So he just stood there after that, not saying anything, looking suddenly out of place and unsure of himself, which was a state I had never seen him in before. About that time, I remember my mother running up screaming Jip's name. She loved that dog. Loved him almost as much as she loved Tim and me, I thought. She had already called a veterinarian. Now she was barking out orders in her manner to my father. We got to use your car to take Jip to the hospital, I remember telling my father. Now he looked really stricken. And I imagine him thinking of Jip's mongrel blood getting all over the new seats of his brand new car. I knew he couldn't stand the idea. It was all in his eyes and his body language. But he didn't say anything about that. Because her mother was there. Because her mother. But said instead, what are we going to do about the boy's present? The cocker spaniel that I brought him. Leave him in the house with the boys, my mother said, wrapping Jip up in a blanket she had brought down with her. She picked him up and moved towards my father's car. Jip didn't growl or bare his teeth at my mother. That was weird. Maybe he knew what she was doing, unlike Timmy or myself. Come on, Quincy. Come on, Quincy, she said back over her shoulder at my father. Let's go. The doctor's waiting. Then she turned to me and Timmy, who had come back down with her, and said, you boys, get that cocker spaniel out of that car and take him upstairs until your father and I get back. Hurry. But I don't want that dog, I said, on the verge of throwing a fit. But one look from my mother's steely cold eyes told me I better get that dog out of the car and take it upstairs, and in a hurry. I did, without so much as another whimper. That's how powerful my effect my mother had on me and Timmy back in those days. She was little, but she was powerful. We did never dare sass her because we knew what the consequences of that would be. 10 lashes or more bound and tied to the stake of her anger. It was just too much to contemplate. So we took the puppy upstairs without looking back. And once we got upstairs, I remember thinking secretly how cute the puppy really was. Trying to cuddle up against Timmy's and my legs and looking all pitiful and everything when I hit him upside his head for getting too friendly too quick. After all, we weren't going to keep this motherfucker because Jip was going to live. At least that's what we kept telling ourselves. So why get friendly with this goddamn no-name dog? But we had to eventually admit that this red little puppy was cute and cuddly. Still, we weren't going to get too close to him because of Jip. After all, at least in my mind, I never knew what Timmy thought. This puppy and daddy were the reason Jip got hit in the first place. And no matter how cute and cuddly he was, I couldn't forgive him or my father for that. Anyway, Jip did live. God bless him. Miraculously. And when he came home after a couple of weeks, he had a steel splint that he wore that he mobilized his entire right leg from his shoulder down to his paw. Until the splint was taken off about 6 months later. That's what I remember. Tell me later. Jip would run around the house bumping into everything with that contraption. That little steel contraption. The little cocker spaniel was still there when Jip came home. As a matter of fact, we had grown used to the little sucker and kind of liked him. But mother told us we could only afford one dog. And so we had to choose, and we chose Jip, and that was that. But our father was out of town, and so we had to wait until he got back to give him back his dog. We didn't mind because we were having fun with both of them. But not Jip. He hated that little goddamn dog, whose name was now Little Puppy, because that's what we called him. Jip would try to corner Little Puppy with that contraption he used as a weapon, so he would bite him. And we were always saving Little Puppy from Jip, who was a lot bigger than he was. One time, Jip almost got him and did bite a good-sized plug out of Little Puppy's side. That really scared the shit. That really scared us, so we were kind of relieved when our father came back and came by and got Little Puppy. Still, we were sad to see him finally go. Jip wasn't, and neither was my mother or grandmother, who never got used to Little Puppy getting into all their things and tearing things up and shitting and peeing all over the place. They had already gone through that with Jip and didn't want to go through it again. Plus, Little Puppy was eating them out of house and home and was a little too much for them to afford, given the fact that Timmy, me, and Uncle Alan, who still wasn't working, and Jip were doing the same thing. So they just decided they couldn't afford one more hungry mouth, and that was that. When Daddy came by to pick up Little Puppy, he tried one more time to sell us on the idea that we should keep him. But this was rejected by my mother. My father already hadn't endeared himself with any of us talking about Jip being a mongrel and Little Puppy being a pedigree, a thoroughbred with official papers on that night Jip got hit. Who cared? What did all of this have to do with whether you love something or not? Everybody in our family loved Jip. Why couldn't my father understand this? But he didn't, and he never forgave any of us for choosing Jip over Little Puppy, because every chance he got, he brought it up. And every time he brought it up, it just drove us a little farther apart. And whatever I felt giving away inside me when I first assigned blame to him and Little Puppy for Jip getting hit only gave more and more and tore more and more until finally it became a huge chasm. Only I didn't know all this at the time. This knowledge would only come later and after many rips and tears in our guts and soul. But I still loved and worshiped him and would until the day he died. I want to read three poems and sit down. Say what? These poems, all three of these poems are from my new book, Avalanche. And one is for my good friend and Curtis's good friend and all of our good friends who know him, Dr. Suggs and Dr. Blount, Oliver Jackson. And Oliver Jackson is, as you know, is from St. Louis and is a great, great painter and one of the great painters in the world. And so I wrote this poem for him. It's called The View from Skates in Berkeley. And this poem is about a view. When you look out of this restaurant in Berkeley and you see San Francisco across the way. And that's where Oliver Jackson and I go every time we go to Oakland and kind of sit there and shoot the breeze, or as they say, chew the fat and bullshit. The View from Skates in Berkeley, for Oliver Jackson, homeboy and painter. The clouds were mountains that day, behind the real mountains, sideways from San Francisco, across the tossed bay. The beauty we saw from Skates in Berkeley was real there, stretched out behind sailboats, the wind-driven waves bucking like rodeo horses carrying cowboys. Breaking across the foaming gray water like sand dunes rippling across an empty expanse of desert, mirrored and beautiful. Here, near sunset, we looked out through the wide open windows and took in the view, unbroken from here, under sinking sunlight, the hills' breasts, the gulls resembling small planes, banked over the waves, searching for fish they snapped up in their beaks, under fleecing clouds, streaming up high, crossing the jet stream. The prickling mist hung low over Angel Island like the day after too many drinks fogged up your head in an afternoon sunlight on a day further back in cobwebs than you care to remember. But there, anyway, as a still life you clung to once deep in a long gone memory, the skyline changing behind the tumbling clouds, the architecture trembling through the mist of the shining pearl by the bay, grown up from split open gums of the land like chipped shark teeth or tombstones leaning white and bright into the light, shimmering like the friendship of this meeting is shimmering here because we knew we were what we always thought we were. Homeboys on top of our games, yes, laughing like joyous paint in sprayed mist. The fog overhead hung low over Oakland, as thick as a mattress where you laid down your head full of dreams and painted images in full view of the Bay Bridge, stretching like one of your elegant lines through our view. Here, outside Skate's window, the sun plunging like one of your painted faces into a rabbit wash of gray waves, the wind slapping salt tears across our faces, creased as the American flag is streaked with a rainbow of colors. Here, where we were what we always thought we were, on this day when the moment heaved up the water, surging like our dreams, and we were riding those bucking horse waves, breaking across the doomed kicking waters, mirrored and beautiful. We were strong as we always knew we would be, our view unbroken from here, in Skates, under the dazzling sunlight of our dreams, streaming across the jet stream, high up in the turbulent afternoon of our heads, light and luminous. We were homeboys, Oliver, on this shimmering, rare day filled with flight. Yes, homeboys, Oliver, on this shimmering, rare day filled with light. This poem is called Collage. And I like to read everything when I come here. I don't like to read everything. So this is a new poem. It's called Collage. It's called Collage. You know, your home people tell you what it is, you know. And, you know, really do. That's really true. Collage. And this is a new poem, and Most of these poems have to be worked for my new book. And in this, I was trying to be a painter. And this poem is dedicated to a good friend of mine who's a Cuban painter. His name is Jose Bedia. Inside its own mystery, the poetic line circles back and forth, moving between and around parameters, shifting questions like chess moves. Words strike at the heart of syntax everywhere, deploy their chord changes as notes and musical phrases are cluster like drones silhouetted in a honeycomb. If the voice breaks and its tone is always dry as bone, it's volume mannered, meticulous, never raised above a humming whisper, but as straight as a line cutting through the graph of an EKG heart monitoring machine. Doodad, no accents there, no nuance, no effervescence, as in a spew bursting, spumescent from a sudsing waterfall, the petals of spray holding faces and that foaming articulation there, when dashed over stones in swelling deep basin bottoms, finger-like plumes dancing upward when the water hits the surface hard and is bridge across the light to a shimmering point by a miracle of arching rainbows where the sun rises up through the transparency of misting flesh and the mist veiling waters. Cloud-like breath is atomized in flicks, shadow catchers pick and catch in black and white or luminous color frames shot through their optic lenses like nirvana. And can be a luminous moment of pure magic when snatched from a thrilling once-in-a-lifetime moment and is crystallized there inside an image of what Air Jordan used to create when he soared high above the rest up there in space, as if he were Jimi Hendrix or the Prince of Darkness, Miles Dewey Davis playing Blue on Aura, all playing mantras deep inside themselves without a clue of bullshit or hesitation, without fear of switching gears as they soloed to bloom into flowers of their syncopated magic, shining high up above imitations, their imaginations flying somewhere, perhaps out over the dome of Montana, where the eyes see clouds as shoes or bruising battleships cruising wide open currents of wind, light, skies blue as eyeballs there of some Scandinavian mountain climber, bird tracking through snow, upward towards some summit where we fix now our arrowing gaze and where a flock of birds is a burst of syllables, as in a sprinkling of black notes as winged cars scattering themselves across our view, as if there were a crew of dark dots tapped to the surface of some painting, a collage of impressions flung there, as if they were a herd of nervous eyes hyperventilating, as in body language of new age hip-hop, cultural stew, the colors there dazzling, the aroma of their digital planet Mac attacks, sizzling, staccatic, pungent, inside blooming spices of words flung everywhere as clues of generational breakdown. What else can I tell you, except the world is square instead of round? That there is no meaning to the silly question of if one walks a straight line or staggers up a hill, but an argument over shape, you know, apples or oranges, skinny or fat, or the reason some block-headed gringos slosh beer and act out rows of ugly Americans in Mexico, deep inside the microwave oven of their fogs, perhaps ratcheting up an urge of Jeffrey Dahmer, a bar or two of nuclear burnout blues, whacked out on the bullshit tip of Walt Disney's Mouseketeering trip, or stretched out on sun-fried sands of cash-and-carry brains, oozing madly all over grid-lock freeways of L.A. every day. Hey, we're talking about MTV informational meltdown here. A blizzard of cardboard images hacked up and dropped in a frenzied celebration of confetti on ticker tape parade. I mean, the whole world changed after that mushroom cloud bloomed and left all those incinerated shadows inked into the world's collective brain, but whose children then rose up through schematas and grids and computer chips to strangle the money flow in the throats of the mad bombers of the West and diverted away a gaggle of dream greenbacks to their squirrel's nest located somewhere in official Tokyo. Imitations of cowboys and rockers there, too. At best, a weird imitation with the culture of those who bombed them. Somewhere in the West, on a clear day in June, when eyes seem to see forever, reaching out, covering space from perception to recognition, what is seen, though, might not always be true. but it's only possibility, suggesting what might be true. As in a mirage, when our eyes tell us what we see there, square dancing in front of us, or Xerox copies of Middle American Porkers, who are copies of other copies, of other copies, and on and on and on, ad infinitum. But what might be truer is what that those copies we think we see are only white styrofoam sculptural forms of Jarred Seagull. Unctuous illusions caught in shifting light, outlining magical tricks. The art of seeing plays on our terrified minds. Images grafted through our eyes. Wheedling spin doctors of influence lay down on us, as in a photo of Air Jordan seemingly walking up there through space, his outstretched arm and hand holding a basketball, his leonine body a picture of lean beauty, strength, and grace. And the black and white colors showing no tension at all. This last poem is a title poem for the book and is dedicated to my good friend Curtis Lau, who gave me the title of this poem called Avalanche. Within an avalanche of glory, hallelujah, sky breaks, spraying syllables on the run, spreading sheets, waving holy sounds, solos sluicing African bound, transformed here in America from voodoo into hoodoo, inside tonguing blues, snaking horns, where juju grounds down sacred up in cars, up in the gritty foo-foo, magical, where fleet rounds up cadences, whirlpool, as in rivers, where memory spins down, foaming into dances, like storms swallowed here in a burst of suns, up in the yeasting blue voodoo, holding the secret clues, mom, inside the mystery unfolding, up in the caking dish rag of daybreak, miracles shaking out earthquakes of light, like mojo hands luminous with spangling, and all the vamping blood songs of call and response, the vamping blood songs, call and response. As in the pulpit, when a preacher becomes his words, his rhythm those of a sacred blues man dead outside his door, his gospel intersecting with antiphonal guitars, a congregation of amens. As in the slurred riffs, blues strings run back, echoing themselves, answering the call, the voice cracked open like an egg, the yolk running out, the lungs imitating collapsed drums. And he is the rainbow and confluence of sacred tongues, the griot, the devotion of rivers, all up in his hands, all up in his fingers, his call, both invocation and quaking sermon, running true and holy as drumming cadences brew in black church choirs. Glory, hallelujah, vows spreading from their mouths like Wolfman's mojo, all up in Mahalia Jackson's lungs, howling vows rolled off hoodoo consonants, brewing magic all up in the preacher's run of muddy water, strung all up in the farm, drenched with coal train, ripping all up in mouths of Lightning Hopkins' mojo songs, blues yeasting lungs of bird when music is raised up as prayer and lives healing as June's sun quilted into black baby's tongue, sown deep in their lungs as power. And this is a poem in praise of continuity. It's a poem about blood coursing through tongues. It's a praise song for drowned voices lost in middle passage. It's a praise song for slashed drums over Batala. It's a construct of Orikis linking antiphonal bridges. It's a praise song, tongue-in-deep mojo seekers, Dambala, in praise of the great God's blessings. Oshun, in praise of healing songs sown into tongues, inflating sweet lungs into a cacophony of singing. And this poem is about music. Music, when music is what it believes it is, holy, when voices harmonize, somersaulting in flight, and glory is the miracle poetry sings to in that great getting up morning, within the vortex of wonder, confluencing rivers, light, glory in the rainbow, arching like eyebrows across suns, glory in the moonlight, stand from a one-eyed cat's head, and I want to be glory and flow in that light, want to be cold-trained solos living in me, want to become wonder, birds in flight of my lines, want the glory of song healing in me as sunlight, want it tongue through leaves, metaphor and trees, transform where they seed and stand up here as people in this soul, everything rooted here in blood of mother's flesh. And here's the poetry of God in deep forest time, singing and listening. And the music there is green, as it also is purple, as it also is orange brown, and mind-blowing electric banana, as it is red cinnamon, and also again, yes, green sound ground up against lavender beneath sunsets, fusing crisp blue light and and night here stitched with fireflies flicking gold up against bold midnight. And once again, yes, green as shimmering Caribbean palm fronds are green in the green center of apocalyptic chaos. And my poem here is reaching for that greenness, is reaching for holy luminosity, shimmering in gold fleck light, where the mojo hand is seaming through high blue mornings, waving like a sequin glove up in the glory of hallelujahs, calling through the inner tube lips of the great God, singing up in the blues with doctors, jack-legging sermon up in the condolences, morning death, up in the sunburst of God's glory. I want this poem to kneel down its before healing, wanted to be magic there beneath the crucifixion of light, wanted to be praise song, juju written, wanted to be mojo hand raised up to powers of flight, wanted to be tongue of gritting foo foo feeding, wanted to be a congregation slurring amen riffs running back through me to you, the voice raised up there, guitar blues licks holy, wanted to be glory hallelujah, call and response glory, wanted to be yam song rooted in the bloody river holy, wanted to be ground of the resurrection, resurrection in you, in me, the bridge tongue of healing is the drum of this song, and it is reaching out to you to cross over to the sun. It's reaching out to touch your heartbeat there, to become one in the glory, to feel the healing touch, to become one with the glory. This poem waits for you to cross over the heartbeat touch of your healing. This poem waits for you to cross over. This poem waits for you to cross over, to cross over. This poem waits for you to cross over, love. This poem waits for you to cross over, love. This poem waits for you to cross over.